It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Have you seen changes in the dress codes at your job? You're not alone. Many workplaces across industries, especially in office settings, have adopted relaxed policies and guidelines about what employees can wear to work. That includes, for a little while anyway, Congress. Recently, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer made a short-lived change to the U.S. Senate dress code to allow senators to wear pretty much whatever they want on the floor. Republicans in Congress and some Democrats criticized the move, saying the Senate should be a place of professionalism and decorum. Democratic Senator John Fetterman from Pennsylvania came under particular scrutiny for wearing basketball shorts and hoodies to Capitol Hill. Here's Chris Hayes interviewing Senator Fetterman on MSNBC.
Let me start with the most important matter facing our country at this dire moment, which is the matter of the Senate dress code. Which has recently been changed.
Of course. I've heard that some people are upset about that. And you know, like I said, aren't there more important things we should be talking about rather than if I dress like a slob?
Days after the change, the Senate passed a bipartisan resolution reinstating business attire on the Senate floor. Our next guest is a fashion historian who says a recent trend toward casual wear at work isn't a reason to panic. Fashions come and go, but it does represent an interesting shift in our culture. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What is the dress code like where you work? Have standards loosened in recent years? Are you happy about a move to more casual and comfortable work wear in many settings? Or are there places where dressier professional clothes should make a comeback? And you work at a place where there's no choice. You wear the scrubs or the uniform or the safety gear. Are you glad you don't have to think about what to wear? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Linda Prebyszewski is an associate professor of history at the University of Notre Dame, author of The Lost Art of Dress. Linda, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks, Rob.
Most of us don't work in the U.S. Senate, Linda, but when this story broke, this is a little while back, do you think it was something worth thinking about and paying some attention to?
I was curious as to what the purpose was, because the Senate usually takes itself pretty darn seriously. And then I saw some pictures of Fetterman and I thought, okay, I think I'm against gym shorts in the Capitol.
Now, is this, and I've mentioned a couple times, it seems like more workplaces are getting a little more casual. Do you see that happening? And if so, why?
Well, there was a shift towards what they used to call Casual Friday in, I'm thinking, the late 90s, the early aughts. And the interesting thing was women actually found it annoying because they felt they now needed a third wardrobe. Right, formal work wardrobe at home with kids, with family, informal wardrobe, and then something in between. But now it's turned into sort of casual Friday all the time, casual every day. This is the thing, though, that I find interesting. It's also casual even if you would like to dress up. Because there are places like Silicon Valley where there are people who have, quite frankly, enormous amounts of money. And yet they're not supposed to wear the beautifully tailored suit that they can afford, you know, because that's not what they're supposed to be wearing. And I think there are different dress codes, but they might be just as annoying to some people as they were before they got really casual.
Now, there are written dress codes for some businesses, but there are also sort of unwritten rules that people don't necessarily come in knowing. Is that something you've watched for, and how complicated can that make things, especially for somebody who's new in the workforce?
Yeah, it's. I mean, most of the people who kind of try to keep young people aware of what they need to think about tell them you need to do, I teach at college, right? So you have young people going into careers, into offices for the first time. And the usual rule is try to dress a little better than you think you're supposed to, if only so people don't think you're slacking off. And then you sort of look around and you realize, okay, what's appropriate, what's considered appropriate in this particular setting. You know, more creative places, they expect you to be more creative in your dressing, whereas places, usually like financial places, right? They expect you to be more conservative because nobody going into a bank or an investment firm really wants to feel nervous about somebody's appearance.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Kaukauna. Michael, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I remember when I started my career in the professional world, I was required to wear, decent dress slacks, a tie, a dress shirt, and a jacket of some kind. And now I see people in work and in church in T-shirts and cut-off jeans with holes in them. I'm going, like, it's gone too far to the casual side. Is how do we strike a balance between the two where people could be comfortable and yet be professional?
Michael, thanks a lot for bringing that up. And Linda, there is a lot of room between, you know, a jacket and tie and those cut-off jeans with holes in them.
Yeah. No, and obviously, being female, I've never been forced to wear a tie against my will. And I do know that there are a fair number of men who simply find the way they fit around the neck to be uncomfortable. But I do think Mike is right that there's got to be a happy medium where, let's put it this way, my rule is unless you clean garages for a living, you should probably be aiming a little higher than that, simply in order to signal competence to people. And that's one of the things I always think about when I see college students going off to write the career fair on campus, is one of the reasons they've put on a suit of some kind or a jacket is that has traditionally been in a way that you said, I'm a person who is competent and in charge of something, and I'm ready to work for you.
Thanks for that call, Michael. We're talking about dress codes at work, whether they exist, how they've changed. Are we getting more casual? Should we get less casual? Linda Prebyszewski is with us, Associate Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. You can join in with your thoughts, maybe what you see at your workplace at 800-642-1234. Linda, I am a guy. I don't love wearing ties. Large Adam's apple doesn't work well for me. But I don't know that guys get a real pity party here. Can you talk about the challenges facing women in trying to decide how to go along with the dress code? It's a little easier for guys in many settings.
No, it is. It's true because, quite frankly, in the early 19th century, this is how far back it goes. There's actually someone who wrote a book called Men in Black. The color options and the decorative options for men narrowed, right? So the color palette got much narrower, much darker, except for playwear. But for serious business wear, right, we got the dark suit. Women have always had a much broader, wider range of clothing available to them. And because culturally, right, fashion has pushed women to expose more flesh and form through their clothing, it's often put them in this awkward situation where they want to be taken seriously as someone working for a living and not someone dating for a living. And yet a lot of the options for women are for dating, right? They're for the big night out. They're not for the office. And it's funny because we really lost, i.e., here's my book, The Lost Art of Dress, a whole set of amazing suit options which existed in the 1950s for women. Where I'm talking, they didn't just look like men's blazers. I actually think women moved into men's blazers in the 70s because they'd forgotten all the amazing options in suits and in what they called dress with jacket looks. But there used to be a very large array of pretty much formal, pretty much covered up, and yet extremely attractive kind of suit options for women. And nowadays it's kind of, I have to say, sometimes it's sort of like every single woman is wearing those pair of black trousers. And you have to realize I love color, I'm a dressmaker, and there are many other options that are dark and serious enough colors, but they're not what I call boring black.
Let's go back to our callers now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I recently had eye surgery plus many other visits at the Eye Institute here in Milwaukee, which is connected with Frederick Hospital. everybody who examined me using very ultra sophisticated pieces of instrumentation wore such sloppy clothes that I was very dismayed. Most of the people looked as if they had been brought off the street and given 20 minutes of instruction. And I think that this is because hospitals now have the feeling that all patients get into a panic and get elevated blood pressure if they're treated by somebody wearing a white lab coat and very professional-looking clothing. And so they've gone overboard. And the people who treated me had crumpled T-shirts, stained and dirty jeans, jeans with holes in the knees, just deplorable clothing. And I will never go back there again, because in an effort to calm patients' nerves, they're forcing people who probably would have preferred to have dressed more in a professional manner, but they're forcing them to come to work in overalls. I mean,
I gotcha, Nancy. I hope the recovery is going okay, by the way. Linda, Nancy, not wild about seeing people underdressed in that medical setting.
Well, to me, the part that really dismayed me the most was people who didn't look like they were clean in the medical center. I mean, one of the things that's really obvious if you look historically at nurses and doctors has always been, right, the original outfits were all white, right? And the idea was, man, those things look bleached. They looked really, really clean. They looked really, really hygienic. And then we saw the move to scrubs, where everyone started wearing scrubs. I'm presuming simply because they're more comfortable, but I think I myself would agree that I do want people to at least look really clean if it's in any kind of medical care setting.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nancy. We're talking to Linda Prebyszewski, Associate Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. We're talking about the rise of casual clothing in the workplace, when it gets too casual, in your opinion, and what, if anything, it says about society. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you wear to work? If you could wave a wand and change your workplace's dress code, what changes would you make? Do you have no choice about what to wear to work? Because there's a uniform or a scrubs requirement, or you name it. You're glad you don't have to think about what to wear. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with fashion historian Linda Prebyszewski about how a lot of workplaces, especially offices, are relaxing their dress codes. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you ever have casual Friday at a workplace? Did you love it or dread it? What do you think? Do you have examples of where people you think are overdressed or underdressed when you encounter them at work? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Dave is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Dave, hello.
Yeah, hi. I was a teacher, and the administrator we had was really big on, if you're going to be a professional, you have to act professional. You should look professional. And it was really interesting. It did garner respect from the students. I think it made a difference. And it's if you can't walk in like a rag doll and expect to get respect from that. And it is a part of the whole picture. And I hated dressing up. I'm a very casual, but it made a difference.
And Dave, in this context, did it mean you wore a suit up in front of the class, or just like nice clothes but short of a suit?
Nice clothes, no jeans. Many of the males, the guys were wearing ties and things like that. I had a non-traditional where it was a possible danger. I did not wear a tie, but I never wore jeans, and it was good. I hated it, but it worked. I think you need to garner respect, and you would look different from the students. You were not them.
Gotcha. Dave, thanks a lot. Linda, this idea that as a teacher or in other settings, we are dressing to set ourselves apart from the people we're encountering in our workday.
Yeah, I mean, when people in the past were taught how to dress, and they literally were taught how to dress, that's what my book is about. One of the things the dress advisor said is, look, when you're out in a public place, and the workplace is one of those places. It's not an intimate setting. It's not where you reveal yourself to people. So in some ways, your clothing needs to be more formal because it's sending the message, hi, we're all here to do something, in particular, work. And the other thing I think of as a teacher is there is an institutional power imbalance, right? And to me, sort of like not having students call me by my first name, the fact that I am not trying to dress like them either is part of it. We're not on the same kind of level institutionally. I'm their professor. And clothing does send a message, as Dave said in his call. And clearly his students got that message.
Dave, thanks for the call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. My senior year at Notre Dame, I was a fireman. I wasn't volunteer, it was paid, but we didn't have a uniform. And I told them when I graduated, I wish Notre Dame Fire Department had a uniform. Well, years later, as an alum, suddenly there's a corner in the bookstore where you could get all this Notre Dame Fire Department apparel. And I was like, I wish I had that when I was, you know, doing the job, because I always admired Star Trek. You know, they had a uniform, they were on duty. And I always liked, you know, the military uniform looks really good. I think a person looks sharp when you have a uniform.
Jeff, I'm sorry you didn't get royalties, because that was your idea for that uniform. Thanks for the call, Jeff. Yeah, I mean, uniforms answer a lot of these questions, Linda, for better or worse.
Right, they do. And they also send a message about being a member of something bigger than yourself, right? You're a member of a corps. It's funny because very often people will say, well, fashion's for women. Only women care about fashion. And I point out that actually military men feel very strongly about their uniforms. And sometimes it's just because they want their uniforms to function, right? But if you've ever seen the Marines in their dress uniforms, you know they also care about the style of it and how good looking it is as well.
Thanks for the call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. Looking at changing dress codes at work, Linda Prebyszewski stays with us, Associate Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. We'll go now to Matt in Waukesha. Matt, hi.
Hello. I was something you hit on just a few moments ago. The idea of this workplace dress code, I think, is a part of a larger public versus private sort of space, which you kind of just mentioned. You know, and it probably comes from a good place of wanting to try to break down some barriers of what, you know, is a stereotype of who's dressing this way and what spaces. But I think it also loses its function, like you said, of you know, kind of, you know, yeah, like the uniform is a great example of that actually too. Like, you know, who is, you know, this, who is the firefighter, who's a paramedic, who is a policeman, if everybody wears a jacket that says that on the back or whatnot, or whether it's teacher, student.
Matt, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. And Linda, that blurring of public-private, well, we had this period where many people in lines of work were working at home, yes. And that may have, how much did that change our thinking about clothing?
I think it did because there were a whole lot of people who did or did not dress. I actually dressed to Zoom classes, so my position was nothing had really changed. Of course, I was trying to reassure, right, a group of undergraduates who was going through one of the most confusing times in their education. But I was also thinking about the fact that I do think there are people who got sick of the not dressing up at all. I think there's a reason why once restaurants opened, people wanted to go out and be in them, and they wanted to go out at night, and they wanted to be able to celebrate. And usually when you actually celebrate some event, you want to wear something special to mark that occasion. So I think, I mean, and to me, the art of dress is actually the ability to dress for everything from, yes, I'm going to clean my garage today or walk my dog or do my gardening too. I am ready for a formal, beautiful event where I get to wear something that's special that I don't get to wear every day.
Thanks for that call. Now, I think sometimes, Linda, when people talk about things like changing dress codes, there can be on the one hand a sense that, okay, society is in decline. Kids today, on the other hand, like from the other end of the spectrum, come on, give it up, things change, whatever. Where do you fall on that huge spectrum?
Well, I kind of do what the dress advisors of old said, which was I look across all the fashion possibilities, and I choose those that I think best suit my life, and my body and my coloring, and I get to have that choice. And one of the things, too, I think, especially I'm an older woman now, is that I do actually prefer to have an emphasis on dignity rather than an emphasis on following the latest thing, because I've seen a lot of the latest things coming and going. And what was very fashionable in, you know, 1 year, 5 years later was looked at as perfectly silly. So I'd like to pick what actually works for me out of all the possibilities. And then enjoy it. Enjoy it as fashion and enjoy it as clothing.
Linda, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Hey, you're welcome. It was fun to be here.
That's Linda Prebyszewski, Associate Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. She joined us for a look at the recent trend toward more casual dress codes at many workplaces. Hey, one more comment. Frances in Milton wanted to say she thinks business casual could be nice slacks with a nice blouse for women, nice pullover sweater for men. Also, I have a note. She would like to know what Rob is wearing. Well, like every day here, full tuxedo, top hat, tails, my little monocle. No, I am very casual. Radio is a very Rob-friendly profession. Intact, usually blue jeans. Black jeans today, though, mixing things up. A usual button-up shirt, but untucked. Because that's just how I roll. I kind of stumbled into that. So the height of, am I a slob? I'm looking to Sarah here. No, I'm not a slob, but I'm not, you know, dressed in a suit on any given day or if I can avoid it, any day. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The debate over freedom of speech and protecting it on college campuses in Wisconsin is in another round. Republican lawmakers in the Assembly have reintroduced a bill that would make some changes to how free speech is regulated and protected on campuses. That would create some significant punishments for public universities and technical colleges that are found to be in violation of students' or employees' rights. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the current state of free speech and expression policies at Wisconsin's institutions of higher learning? Are there changes you'd like to see? Do you have questions about what is in this legislation? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Rich Kramer is a reporter for WPR who covers higher education. Rich, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, thanks for having me.
Now, you reported this is the fourth time we've seen Republican lawmakers circulate a bill like this one. What are the sponsors' main goals as they talk about this?
Well, the main goals, as per the testimony that I've heard a few times now over the years, is to ensure that campuses aren't, first of all, that they're educating students about free speech rights, the First Amendment of the Constitution, and making sure that there are some penalties for campuses or administrators or anyone who violates that. So it's been an ongoing discussion about, you know, what does free speech on campus really mean, and essentially who decides.
Before we dig into the details of the legislation, Rich, what has happened in the past? How far along in the process did a similar legislation get?
Well, basically the bills, and maybe Joe can correct me later on, but the bills have been introduced. There's been some amendments, but they just haven't finished, you know, they haven't crossed the finish line before the end of the session. And, you know, part of that is there's hundreds of bills considered every single session. And, you know, lawmakers have priorities that change from time to time. But these free speech bills, which have changed a little bit over the, the various iterations. They just haven't gotten a full vote, as far as I know, on the in the state assembly or in the state senate. And I know for a fact that they've never made it to the governor's desk. Mm-hmm.
Now let's look at some of the particulars here. One would be requiring regular surveys of students and employees around, as you just mentioned, that First Amendment knowledge, perceived political bias, culture of censorship. We had a survey along these lines. There was some controversy. Could you talk about its role in this legislation, Rich?
Well, I'll say that the legislation or this idea of this bill predates that survey, for what it's worth. That survey was done by the University of Wisconsin System, I believe last year, or the results were released last year. And the essentially it found that you know, conservative students or those that identified as conservatives among the respondents felt less free to give their opinion in class. They were worried that, first of all, their peers would kind of ostracize them. They were worried about social repercussions. They were also worried that they might get a lower grade in some cases if they brought, you know, their conservative viewpoints up in class. And it kind of goes to that idea that we've heard a lot about from conservatives, that, you know, universities are generally very liberal places. That's the main ideology on campus. And that survey also found that liberal students in general were more comfortable, you know, canceling conservative speakers or canceling any speaker for their viewpoints than conservative students were.
Now, a big part of this bill has to do with consequences if any campuses, this is the public university, the University of Wisconsin system, and technical colleges, penalties if they violate norms established in this law of free speech. What could some of those penalties look like?
Well, there's a few of them that I'll rattle off here. Essentially, it would allow students or anyone really who feels that their free speech rights on campus were violated by policies or administrative actions, they could sue the UW System Board of Regents or Technical College Board at the local level. And if a judge agrees that a violation occurred, the person bringing that suit could win damages between, I believe, a minimum of $500 and a maximum of $100,000. It also would potentially result in the loss of what's known as a Wisconsin grant. That's a state grant that goes to universities used for financial aid, essentially, for students. If a university is found to have, I believe it's two violations in a 5-10 year period, something like that. And also, it would require universities that were found to repeatedly violate free speech rights to post on its admissions material that go out to prospective students a statement essentially saying we didn't follow the law with regard to free speech rights, and they'd have to keep that on their materials for 4 years as kind of a warning for prospective students.
Talking to WPR reporter Rich Kramer. He covers, among other things, higher education, looking at a bill in the state legislature aimed at promoting and protecting free speech on college campuses with, as we just heard, penalties for campuses that violate the terms of that law, if it were to become a law. Now, Rich, have we heard a response from the UW, from the technical colleges, as this thing has moved along?
Yeah, there's written testimony, and there was a public testimony at the hearings from spokespeople or government relations people with the University of Wisconsin system or the universities of Wisconsin system and the technical college boards. And in a nutshell, the UW folks say a lot of what you want to do in this bill, we already do in our regent policy. That policy is 4-21, and that changes were made to that a little while back. But proponents of these bills say you need teeth for any of this to really matter. You have to have repercussions. So the UW systems or the UW spokesperson says that, you know, those kind of punishments would adversely impact students' financial aid. That's for one. And also the tech systems had similar concern about these punishments.
And Rich, what is the next piece of this story that you're watching for to see if this legislation moves further than it has in the past?
Yeah, I guess I'll just be watching. You know, the committee had their public hearing, which is the first step you know, after the bill has been introduced, and then they would take a vote in the executive session. Then from there it goes potentially for a full floor vote and a full in the Assembly and Senate, and then to the governor's desk. So beyond that, I mean, I'll just be watching if this bill keeps coming up, if it doesn't make it to the finish line this go round.
Rich, thanks again for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's WPR's Rich Kramer, a reporter who covers higher education. We talked to him today about a renewed Republican effort in the state legislature to update free speech protections on public campuses, including consequences for colleges that are found to have violated them. Coming up, we'll hear from a national group, a supporter of most of the provisions of this legislation, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. You just heard some of the basics there. We'll dig into some more of the details, and you could share your thoughts. Do you think we need to see these kind of changes? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk about free speech and expression on college campuses. Republicans in the legislature have again advanced a bill that would punish universities and technical colleges in Wisconsin that violate a set of free speech guidelines. We heard about some of the details of that bill with WPR reporter Rich Kramer. Joe Cohn joins us now, legislative and policy director for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. He testified last week before the Wisconsin Assembly Colleges and Universities Committee, largely in support of the bill while pressing for a specific change. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
I want to pick up on something Rich mentioned. The response from the university in particular is, hey, the Board of Regents, they're the agency empowered to deal with this kind of stuff. They have a policy in place. What do you see as the need for the state legislature to define things in state statute?
Well, let me say a couple things about that. The first is that, FIRE rates schools' written policies on whether or not they are constitutional and with respect to free speech rights. And there are no schools in Wisconsin that get our green light rating that they're completely constitutional. So the idea that the Board of Regents have really stepped to the plate and done completely the right thing is just wrong. They've made progress. They've made important progress that they should be, recognized for in adopting the Chicago Principles, which is a gold standard kind of statement of the principles at play of free speech. But when rubber hits the road, there are still policies on the ground that do not comply with the First Amendment. The second thing I would say is that the Board of Regents is unable to provide remedies to students when rights are violated, either through institutional policy or if one of their employees does the wrong thing when there's a controversy. Only having real meaningful access to courts fixes that, and the legislature is in a much better position to do that. It's either Congress or the legislature, no one else can.
What are some of the measures you see on Wisconsin public university and college campuses that that fall short of First Amendment protections?
Well, they have overbroad anti-harassment policies that don't track Supreme Court definitions of when speech crosses from being protected but maybe rude to being unprotected, discriminatory, harassing conduct. And tracking those lines is necessary because it's required under the Constitution at public schools, but it's also necessary for people to have kind of the freedom to speak their minds and interact with each other in a non-sanitized way in learning environments where we expect there to be conflict.
Yeah, in the bill, as written up by the Legislative Reference Bureau, the bill would bar, and I'm going to quote here, university rules that, here's where the quote starts, sanction individuals or groups for discriminatory harassment unless the speech targets its victims on the basis of a protected class under law and is so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it effectively bars a student from receiving equal access to educational opportunities or benefits. Now, one could imagine a lot of harassment that's pretty bad that doesn't rise to that standard, and a university saying, well, hold on, we want to have a collegial atmosphere. We need to be able to enforce that. Is it hard to establish that somewhere a middle ground between we're ruining your educational experience completely on the basis of, say, a protected class versus this is worse than we want in our collegial attitude here?
Well, hold on with that. First of all, that language is directly from the United States Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. It's an opinion in Davis versus Monroe County Board of Education authored by Justice O'Connor, but joined by Ginsburg, Souter, Breyer, Stevens. So it's hardly a, you know, conservative perspective on when you have to cross the lines. And the court was very careful in setting it because you expect students to argue with each other. It's the same line in the educational setting, by the way, K-12 and college. And you can see how if you don't require it to be both pervasive and and severe, if it's only one or the other, kids tease each other all the time. Kids go after each other all the time. And if in higher education, you need to be able to have robust disagreements. And, you know, quite frankly, in higher ed, you expect to have arguments and expect to have them sometimes be heated.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Brookfield. Jim, hi.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I think it's necessary, and it's kind of a shame to the institution that they have to be taught what free speech is. I mean, the left and the, you know, the ones who are the liberal people who are running these institutions cannot argue anymore about their policies. And then when they are faced with the argument, they have to call it hate speech. They have to shut it down. It's pretty embarrassing that this has to happen. Not just Wisconsin, it's everywhere. And I'm glad some people are stepping up and starting to not donate at, you know, to these institutions, because I think that's the only thing that's really going to make a difference is when the dollars stop rolling. And I do applaud the efforts here from your guest, and I think he's a great guest, and thanks for having him on. It's another side of this conversation. You're pretty trustworthy to do this. I appreciate that.
Got it. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Joe, your thoughts on what Jim brought up?
Well, first of all, I want to thank him for that. And just say that there's never been a golden era of free speech on college campuses, but we are seeing levels of censorship at institutions of higher education across the country that are unprecedented. The numbers of disinvitations, the numbers of attempts to block speaking events, including circuit court judges at Stanford, you know, University Law School, for example. You know, we are seeing an unprecedented number of attempts to get faculty members fired for saying things that are controversial as well, numbers that far exceed the numbers during the entire Red Scare. So we have to take this threat very seriously. And the only way around it is, well, two prongs. One, we need laws and that require policies that comply with free speech norms and case law. And then the second prong is that we need to work on improving a culture of free speech, which requires a culture of listening to each other, no matter what side of the aisle you're on.
Jim, thanks for the call. Talking to Joe Cohn with the Group Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or FIRE, about legislation filed by Republicans, the fourth attempt to pass something like this on free speech and expression on college campuses, and consequences if those policies aren't followed. Joe, I wanted to bring up one point on this legislation that you opposed in your testimony, and that has to do with the venue where some of these things are argued. It could involve courts, but under the legislation, it could also be a legislative committee, and you have concerns about that.
Yeah, I do. So this bill has provisions on campus free speech that we've talked about, and it has provisions on academic freedom for faculty that we haven't yet talked about. But the third section of the bill provides robust due process protections for students so they can't be expelled without fair procedures. Wisconsin is one of three and only three states in the country where there is no due process right to continued right to an education. But one problem with this bill is that it allows for a committee of the legislature to hear complaints that schools cut corners in these disciplinary proceedings. Now, that interjects politics into that process in a way that's unproductive and potentially unconstitutional with the separation of powers problem. But lastly, it's also just unwise. Do we really think the legislature's time is best spent hearing as an sitting as an appellate body over every campus due process case at all of your institutions of higher education? I don't think so.
Let's go back to our callers. Andrew is with us in Milwaukee. Andrew, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the call. I was interested in hearing an opinion about the actions of Ron DeSantis in Florida, essentially outlawing pro-Palestinian student groups and the politicization or the political appointed board of regents, and how politics could play into what is acceptable free speech or unacceptable free speech.
Andrew, thanks for the call. And Joe, I believe I saw a statement from FIRE on that issue in Florida that Andrew's talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Andrew, for that question. A lot of what's happened across the country is just unconstitutional, including what you described in Florida. You know, the right to protest is an essential part of free speech. It doesn't depend on people being right about their cause. And in fact, you know, the Constitution itself requires viewpoint-based neutrality so that we don't have those determinations when deciding who has the right to engage in protests. Now, not all of the protests will necessarily be constitutional. You can cross lines. You can block egress from buildings. That's alleged to have happened at Cooper Union in New York, where it looks like students were barricaded in a library, Jewish students, by an angry mob of protesters. That's not protected conduct. So, you know, but across the board, the right to just engage in speech in support of the Palestinian cause is protected, even if, you know, it proves, you know, over the test of time that their cause lacked merit. The First Amendment doesn't make those determinations.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Excuse me. Roger joins us in Two Harbors, Minnesota. Roger, hi.
Good afternoon. I was a student at the University of Minnesota at Duluth in 1965. The university had, at that time, I hope it still does, a strict policy of the speakers cannot incite to riot or rebellion. They have to be sponsored by a student group. We had Arnold Johnson, who was treasurer of the American Communist Party, and George Lincoln Rockwell, who was America's chief Nazi, speaking a day apart. And, of course, there was controversy, but the university officials said they met the requirements so they can speak. And the provost said even President Kennedy in 1963, 2 years earlier, had to be sponsored by a student group, the Young Democrats. And I feel that's what should be the policy. Thank you much for giving me my little speech.
Roger, thanks for the call. Joe, is that the attitude you'd like to see?
Well, you know, thanks, Roger. It certainly isn't a constitutional problem in a lot of parts of the country. The circuits are not even on this. They're not uniform on this question, but it's constitutionally allowed in a lot of the country to make a distinction between those who are invited guests and just the public's right to use university spaces. What I would say is that no matter how hateful you think some speech is, there is value to society in having it out in the open versus suppressing it, because suppressing speech doesn't eliminate those attitudes, doesn't change hearts and minds. It pushes it underground where it festers, where it metastasizes. So, you know, people do themselves a favor, you know, do our society a favor, sorry, when they put their ideas out in the public to be evaluated, scrutinized, and sometimes even viciously criticized.
Thanks for that call. Joe, as we've mentioned, this legislation in Wisconsin, the fourth try here. Do you have any sense that it is any more likely to advance further in the legislature this time around?
Well, I hope so. And we're going to be trying to get it all the way through. The lower house, you know, has a lot of drive to get this done. It's yet to be seen if the Senate is equally interested in moving this forward, but over 21 states have passed bills, and a lot of them with very broad bipartisan support. And this is one of the better bills in the country once that line we discussed is cut. It's one that doesn't take a partisan perspective on free speech rights, that mimics Supreme Court standards on different types of speech codes that are common across the country. And students of all different political persuasions will benefit from having these rights locked up into law with an ability to vindicate their rights if they're violated in court.
Joe, we'll leave it there. Provide. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Joe Cohen with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or FIRE. We talked to him about his group's support for a Republican bill in the state legislature that would make some changes around free speech on college campuses in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, if you feel lonely these days, you are not alone. Find out why public health experts are worried about the impacts of widespread loneliness around the United States. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. I told you a few weeks back about a record-breaking pumpkin. Now there's another pumpkin-related record, and it's a work of art. As reported by Smithsonian Magazine, the owners and staff of a farm in England just set the world record for the largest ever mural created with pumpkins, squash, and gourds. The mosaic is a good Halloween theme. It's a tribute to Jack Skellington from the movie The Nightmare Before Christmas, released 30 years ago this month. The mosaic is over 2,000 square feet, made from over 10,000 pumpkins and gourds. I learned a new word. This is a cucurbita mosaic. That's the genus name for pumpkins and close relatives. I won't try to replicate the project in my garden. One, it's too small to grow 10,000s of these cucurbita plants. Two, I haven't gotten great results just trying to grow one or two. This is Halloween on Central Time. Everybody make a scene, trick or treat.